Welcome back to Living More of a Life, the podcast which helps raise awareness of issues which stop us living more of a life. As you might have noticed from the last few, I've got into some rather meaty topics. In today's episode, we talk about what happens when you start as a people pleaser and how that can go into different issues within life. One, for example, that we talk about here is repetitive strain injury or overworking, burnout at work, burnout at home potentially as well. The other in this particular story is discussing a coercive control relationship, one where somebody becomes stuck in a relationship where there's a form of domestic abuse that's often psychological. It's important to note that it's not always women who are the victim. Men can be as well. I'm taking some details here from womensaid.org.uk, where it says that domestic abuse isn't always physical. Coercive control is an act or a pattern of acts of assault, threats, humiliation, and intimidation, or other abuse that is used to harm, punish, or frighten their victim. This controlling behaviour is designed to make a person dependent by isolating them from support, exploiting them, depriving them of independence, and regulating their everyday behaviour. They campaigned and succeeded in making coercive control a criminal offence. This has only been a criminal offence since 2015. Since opening myself up to talking about all of these type of topics, I found that people I know or people that I meet have started to open up a little bit, and they've started to share some of their past with me that they wouldn't usually share. It's surprising when you realise what someone's been through and yet how strong they seem now. Of course, I had only knowingly spoken to the survivors of these situations. I'm starting to see that some friends and acquaintances are actually opening up about issues they're currently experiencing as well. This might not be as extreme as a coercive controlling relationship, for example. It might be a health issue or other personal battles. It's not my place to necessarily fix their situation, but to be somebody who listens can be rewarding in itself. Let's get into today's episode. I'm your host, Jane Tarrant, and I've got with me Helen Snape. Helen, what does it mean to you to live more of a life?
To me, it means living to my soul's purpose. And I can honestly say I didn't know what on earth that was for most of my life until about 2 years ago. And now I do. Because I think we all deserve to have the best out of life, but we really only can do that when we are living our soul's purpose.
That sounds really intriguing. Can you explain to me what you mean by soul's purpose?
So I've been through a lot in life, and I kind of often wondered, you know, why? You know, why did that happen to me? And, you know, maybe there isn't really an explanation for it. But I can see from what I've been through and what I've learnt, how I can now help other people that are going through what I went through and are in kind of the same space that I was in, and just trying to figure out, God, how do I do life differently?
I can totally relate to that.
Yeah. And I feel called to do it. So, you know, there are times when I doubt myself and I think, you know, oh, you know, who am I to kind of be putting myself out there and helping people in this way? And then I'm like, well, if I don't do it, you know, who is going to do it? You know, get over yourself.
Absolutely. I mean, who is better to help somebody else than somebody who's already been through what it is?
Yeah.
So can you explain a little bit about what it is you have been through? We'll do a bit of an overview and then we'll dive a bit deeper in.
Yeah. I experienced burnout at work, and I developed really bad repetitive strain injury through overworking. But my desire to just do and to help other people so much also expanded into my personal life and into my romantic relationships. And I ended up in a controlling and abusive marriage for 18 years.
18 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And it came from a place of being a giver and always thinking about the other person and never really wanting to think about myself.
Interesting.
Yeah. So until 5 years ago.
When you say not wanting to think about yourself, what do you mean by that?
I thought it was selfish to think about myself. I used to like pride myself on being a given person. You know, I thought it was good. You know, I thought it was good to look out for other people and help other people. And that biblical saying about, you know, love other people as you love yourself. I thought, well, I'm not so sure about the loving myself part, but I can do the loving other people. And surely that's good enough, right?
And was this something from your childhood? How did you learn that it would be selfish to love or to look after yourself rather than looking after other people before yourself?
Mm. I think it developed in several kind of different ways. I remember, you know, growing up as the good girl of the family. And I think there was something about realizing that I would get love and attention, you know, if I behaved, if I was polite, if I got good grades, if I didn't complain about things. And I think that's reinforced by, you know, by school and by society. And I got stuck into this pattern of just like trying to fit in with everyone else. And yeah, of trying to never be a moment's problem. And some of the time that did get me kind of the love and attention that I was looking for. And a lot of the time it didn't.
So is this a kind of a people pleasing concept?
Absolutely, yeah.
But you noticed this in yourself even while you were quite young?
Yes, but I thought it was a good thing. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And I know, you know, some of it developed from school, from being bullied at school, because I'm blind in one eye and I was bullied for that. And I couldn't make it stop. And so I learned that, you know, for me, part of the solution was, well, just become as invisible as I can. And when that didn't work, just try to blend in with everyone else. Yeah.
So you would never want to shine or show up in many ways. It would be a case of doing what you could to get by, to have people like you, but not to be noticed too much.
Absolutely. Yeah, if the attention was on me, then I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand it.
And what about when it was really good attention, when it was, you know, praise for, you know, a good level of academic achievement or sporting or whatever it is?
I appreciated it, but I still felt uncomfortable with it. There was a part of me that would lap it up, but there would be part of me that felt really uncomfortable around receiving praise or compliments or even a lot of attention.
Interesting. And so how did that move into your career and into your relationships? What did it make you act like? How did it make you come across to your colleagues or, you know, the best way you can describe that, I guess?
In my career, I became the yes woman at work. So if there was a new project to be done, then I'd say, yeah, I'll do it. Or, you know, if a colleague was struggling with their own deadline, then I'd say, well, I can help. You know, I would offer to help and I would just take on more and more work. And of course, you know, the reward for doing really good work is to be given more work, right? And so that is what would happen. And so I just found myself taking on more and more, but not actually getting any recognition for it, or sometimes like even any thanks for it, because I guess I just made it really easy for people to give work to me and just then expect me to do it, because I would just take it on and not complain.
And did you feel that you were then taken advantage of in that way?
In a way, yes. But I think I have some responsibility there because of how I was showing up. Like, you know, probably some people just thought, well, of course, like Helen can take this on because she said yes. So that must mean she's okay with that, right? Whereas I'm sure there were other people that, you know, knew that actually I had loads on but they knew that I was going to say yes. So maybe they were taking advantage.
Interesting. And you kind of created this burnout situation for yourself. What sort of age are we at this point before you got into this particular romantic relationship that was so bad?
So the burnout at work must have happened when I was about age 30. So I was married by then. But I was, you know, heading towards burnout at work because I just was typing like nonstop all the time, and I didn't want to take breaks, and I would begin to feel pain at night in my arms and my wrists and my shoulders, but I just ignored that. And then I began to feel pain during the day, like when I was at work, but I wasn't going to let that stop me either. And it wasn't until I literally couldn't type anymore that I had to say something and go and see a doctor and go and find some help for that.
And did you get the help?
I just saw a doctor who recommended rest and painkillers. And I knew that I needed to change things more than that, but I wasn't sure how. So I got a couple of books which had really good reviews on repetitive strain injury. And that was incredibly helpful because it took a more integrated approach to how to treat RSI and then how to prevent it from coming back, or how to manage it in your life. And it didn't just look at, you know, what's going on with your wrists and your arms. You know, it looks at things like posture and taking regular breaks and ergonomics, but also, you know, how are you as a person? Because people that develop RSI do tend to be like obsessive workers. Like whatever has driven them to that place, they're just workaholics.
And when was it during this process that you realised that the issue wasn't necessarily the RSI, it was actually more to do with what made you get down that road? When was it you noticed that?
It was when I read a book called kind of a corny title, but it's called It's Not Carpal Tunnel Syndrome. because it was coming from the point of view that a lot of people get diagnosed with carpal tunnel syndrome in their wrists from RSI, but its point is that actually in a lot of cases, you know, the problems are coming from your back and your shoulders, and actually how you hold yourself at the computer, and actually it's your obsessive work ethic as well that is contributing to it. And that was a wake-up call for me.
For it to come from a kind of mental point of view as well, that kind of that work ethic as opposed to just posture.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Interesting. And by this point, you said you were already married. You know, were you taking on a lot at home as well?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So I got married straight after university. I met my husband at university, and he was charming and intelligent, and I was young and in love. And I didn't see the red flags that were there.
Was he your age?
He was about 10 years older than me.
It's not the first time I've heard that in this sort of situation. So he was about 10 years older than you. You were a student, young, impressionable, falling in love. He was charming and, you know, attractive, etc. What happened? You know, how did it kind of proceed, and what warnings were there that you maybe didn't notice that you can look back on now?
He would get very angry very quickly, and he would sometimes fly into rages, like almost, uncontrollable rages, where I think almost he wasn't even like present in his head anymore. And it was quite frightening. But when he would calm down from those, he would give me explanations about how this was because of his health situation, and he didn't understand it, and, you know, and he would say, you know, how he didn't want to be like that, and how he just needed to figure out what was going on, and he thought it was to do with his diet. So he had kind of all these like reasons and excuses for, you know, why he would get so angry and fly into these rages, and I guess I wanted to believe him. And I, you know, so I kind of felt sorry for him, and I bought into his story, and I did. I felt sorry for him, and I felt that other people didn't understand what he was going through. And so, of course, you know, he was saying to me how much, you know, he appreciated that I did understand. And he lavished on me, you know, this amazing attention, and I lapped it up. And I hadn't really had any better experiences of relationships with men before. I'd had a couple of boyfriends, which were also quite disastrous. So I didn't really know any better. And I became an evangelical Christian at university, and I kind of picked up on the idea of, you know, well, love is about commitment, and love is about sacrifice. You know, it's not meant to be easy. You know, you love people on their good days and on their bad days. And so it led me to like not expect anything more, really.
And so he had these rages. What were the other sort of clues as to a controlling behavior in the early days of your relationship?
I think it's that he wanted to spend a lot of time alone with me. And so I began to spend a lot less time with friends at university. And he would begin to pick up how my, you know, my friends were like not being nice to him, or how they weren't nice people. And so he's beginning to kind of set up like divisions between me and my friends. And then when he met my family as well, he really did not get on with my family. And he would, you know, tell me after we'd visited them, you know, how he felt that they were being disrespectful towards him. And I couldn't really understand it. But, you know, but he was my, you know, he was my partner, and I wanted to believe him. You know, if he felt disrespected, well, he felt disrespected. But of course, looking back, I can see, you know, he was beginning to, again, like create divisions, trying to kind of separate me from my support network.
Oh gosh. And you're in the situation and you're literally just after university age.
Yes. Straight out of university. Yeah.
And you have this situation where one, he's separating you from everything else that you know, all your other support structures, all the people that have been there for years for you that you've chosen in your life or that you were given in your life, be it family or friends. And then he's created this sort of personal barrier, wants to be with you on his own a lot of the time, keep you to himself, has rage or uncontrollable events, but is very sort of, I guess, remorseful or has lots of excuses for it. But he also then sort of allows you to kind of take his side because he lavishes love on you and he makes you feel special in a way that's maybe much more intense than anybody else ever has.
Oh gosh, absolutely. Yeah. It was like brilliant sunshine. You know, like when he turned on the attention and the love, it was stunning. And I don't think I'd really felt that before from any other guy. And so, you know, rather than asking, you know, is this relationship good for me? I just lapped up that attention because I felt desperate for it. Yeah.
And had you previously told him of any rifts between you and family or issues between you and friends, anything that would encourage him to pick up on that you maybe would be better off without them? Was there anything you had said that he could have potentially used, or was it purely his dislike for the way they treated him or made him feel, and actually you had never had any issues in that sense with your current support network?
It was all coming from him. Yeah, he was creating it. Yeah, because I got on okay with my family, and I really like my friends. So, he was creating problems.
And did any of your family or friends speak to you about it? Did any of them show a concern or say that there's something they're not quite sure about with this chap?
My family did. They did not like him at all. But I guess the problem with that was that, you know, my parents hadn't liked either of my previous boyfriends, like probably with good reason. But you know, to me, it felt like, oh, you know, well, they don't like the current guy I'm with again. You know, well, there's no surprises there. And I was like blindly in love by that point. I don't really remember my friends saying anything, and I'm not sure why that is, or maybe they did and I don't remember.
Interesting. And this then went on for 18 years. So can you talk me through the next number of years and how it progressed?
Some of it is a blur, to be honest. And that's probably like my mind protecting me from remembering all of it. But, you know, we lived at his mum's for a very short period, and then we moved to Cambridge and lived there for a number of years. And I remember in the early days, we would have some blazing rows. You know, everything had to be done his way. Like, there was no like room for compromise. And things just became very controlling. So, for example, you know, he would need to have his meals at a particular time because he said, you know, he needed that because of his health, which was this weird undefined thing. You know, and then if he didn't eat on time, then he'd get really cross and he'd fly into a rage. But then he'd put that down to this health thing that was going on with him. And I have no idea to this day, like, how much of that was real and how much of it was just him trying to control me.
Interesting. And did you do all the cooking, all the shopping?
Yes. Yes, I did all the cooking, all the shopping, all the washing, all the house cleaning, and hold down a full-time job. In the early days, I also got a second job at the weekend to fund him going and doing some further education. So yeah, I was flat out. I didn't have any time for myself. But of course, remember, I thought that, well, that's good, right? You know, I'm being so helpful to my husband. And, you know, and hoping, I guess, that he would really appreciate it.
And did he show appreciation?
Occasionally he would. I guess it became this like intermittent kind of reinforcement thing. So occasionally he would. And I would like, you know, like bask in his appreciation. But most of the time he didn't. Like, he would just take it for granted and find ways to criticize what I had done.
And effectively then making you lose your confidence in yourself?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I didn't. Yeah, I mean, I don't think I ever really had much confidence in myself. And that, yeah, marriage did not help. Yeah.
So what else happened? Obviously, you were doing all the chores, you were making sure things were ready on time for him, you were caring for him in every way possible and sometimes felt appreciated. What else happened during this time?
We would, you know, obviously sometimes see friends. Very occasionally, you know, he would get really angry when we were with friends. So occasionally other people would see that. But, you know, they just put it down to, oh, well, that's just who he is. And never really asked me like how I was about it. The only times people kind of commented to me about it was almost like to complain about his behavior, like as if I could change it. Like, you know, just be like, oh, you know, he's, you know, he really can't go around being like that. And I'd be like, well, what, you know, what do you expect me to do about it? You know, and kind of being given like this responsibility to help change him somehow.
Did you seem happy when you were out in public?
Yeah.
Were you affectionate towards each other?
Yeah, we were. Yeah.
So from the outside, it looked like potentially like a happy relationship.
Yes. Yeah.
And you felt that he did love you and you felt that he did care for you and that you needed him and that he needed you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I think there was definitely that we felt that we loved each other. But yeah, there's also very much needing each other as well, underlying that. Yeah.
And this is obviously a very controlling situation. The difference between control and abuse is sometimes difficult to define. Was there any of what you would consider abusive behavior towards you?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, I think the control does come into it. But he would also, you know, make me just feel bad about myself, like about my body. You know, there were bits of my body he did not like. And so, you know, that felt horrible. I mean, I think in a way I was fortunate in that I think I've always had quite a positive body image. So that kind of didn't hit so hard as perhaps other things that he said, but it was still horrible. But, you know, him like accusing me of being selfish, for example, like I would really take that to heart, because to me that would be like the worst thing to be.
That would so be like the ultimate sin, considering everything you were doing was to not be selfish. How could you possibly think you were selfish? What more could you do? That kind of concept.
And he would do things like, he would just make, he was very clever and things were very subtle with him. But for example, I just found myself less and less wanting to go out and socialize with other people, because I knew that I would pay for it. So for example, you know, sometimes I would want to go out after work and socialize with people, but I knew, for example, that I had to like make him his dinner on time, otherwise he was going to get cross and cranky. So even if I, but even if I arranged to make sure that that somehow happened, I knew he would not like for me to be going out and socializing. And so even if I got home at a reasonable time and he'd managed to have something to eat, that he wouldn't like have a go at me for having gone out, but he would find something else to get cross about. Like, I don't know, like the soap is sitting in the wrong place. And he would just manage to make that a really big deal and just accuse me of, like, I don't know, moving it deliberately and you know, and that was really problematic. And he'd like work himself up into a rage about it. And so it kind of, I mean, it was frightening. It was really frightening. And it kind of made me feel like I was going kind of crazy, because I couldn't understand, you know, why he would get so cross about such little things.
And did you correlate it to the fact that it was only after you'd done something like going out and seeing friends that he would do this sort of thing? Did you start to notice a pattern?
I eventually began to notice it. Yeah.
And when did you start to realize there might actually be something wrong?
It was probably about a year before I ended up leaving my marriage.
So after about 17 years.
Yeah.
And you were how old by that point?
About 38. Yeah.
Wow.
Maybe I was beginning to kind of get to the point of having a breakdown. I don't know. But I just felt like I couldn't cope. I just couldn't cope with doing everything at work, with handling all of the responsibilities for the household, supporting my husband actually in his work as well, and, you know, what was going on in our marriage. And so I remember getting some telephone counselling via my employer at the time. So that was kind of like a first step for me. But the telephone counselling wasn't particularly helpful. I think perhaps the counsellor didn't appreciate quite the extent of what was going on.
Was it because you weren't able to be honest about it, because you didn't realise that there was something to tell her or him?
I think I was explaining it. I don't know quite what it was, but they seemed to kind of just aim things at, you know, how can you, you know, talk to your husband about this, and how can you kind of repair the marriage? And I was saying to them, well, I don't even think I can talk to him about this, because he'll just get really angry. And so I just felt quite stuck in that particular counselling.
Do you think they were there from a point of view of trying to give you empowerment and get you to kind of deal with your own issues, but they maybe weren't trained in the kind of on picking up on domestic abuse situations?
Yeah, quite possibly. Yeah. Yeah, because I'm sure they were, you know, doing the best they could to help me. It just wasn't the best fit, I think.
Of course.
And then I think what happened was I just had a little bit of a wake up at a New Year's Eve party that we went to, because the pattern was that we would go to these parties and it would be my role to make sure that I made him a lot of drinks throughout the evening, because he would say that, you know, if he got dehydrated, then he would get really cranky and cross. And, you know, and so he would expect me to, you know, kind of make sure that he ate and drank sensible things. And I just remember, like, there was like this little rebellious part of me. And I was like, I'm at a party. Like, I want to be able to talk to people and not be constantly thinking about, oh, you know, does my husband need a drink or something to eat? And so although I did still make him a few drinks, I perhaps didn't make quite as many as I normally would. And then I wanted to go home a little bit early, and he wanted to stay out longer. So I went home, and he followed several hours later in an absolutely foul mood. He was so angry. And, you know, he said that he'd shouted at a lot of people at the party, and it was my fault. It was my fault because I hadn't been giving him enough attention. I hadn't been making him drinks, and, you know, and I'd left early, left him there on his own. And there was just a small part of my brain saying to me then, this is ridiculous. Like, even though I was just really scared and didn't know how to respond to him, there was just a small part of my brain saying, this is ridiculous. Like, this, you know, this cannot carry on.
Wow. And was he ever physically abusive?
No, he wasn't. There were occasions when I felt scared, because he's a lot bigger than me and he's very strong. And when people fly into a rage, it's almost like they have a lot more strength, you know. And so he, after many years in the marriage, actually, when he began to get angry, he would occasionally start to throw things. He never threw them at me. He would maybe throw them near me. But I think somewhere again in my brain, I was beginning to clock that, you know, oh, well, this is new. He didn't used to do that. And then towards the end of our marriage, he also, you know, would start, he started, like, if he got really angry, he would like start spitting. And it was just kind of frightening, like, that I just felt like that things were beginning to escalate.
And I guess it was the case of, he hadn't hit you, but that didn't mean he couldn't. And, you know, it's a fine line between it never happening and it happening for the first time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what did you do to get out of this situation?
Well, I think the turning point came for me when my mum got diagnosed with an incurable cancer. So that was back in 2015. And when I got the news, I think that was a real wake-up call. It just began to make me realize how short life is, how precious life is. And I just thought, I deserve a better life than this. And, you know, I already kind of felt like I was going a bit crazy in the marriage. And it prompted me to go and seek a therapist. So that really was my first step. Going to see a therapist because I thought I was going crazy. Like I just felt I couldn't cope and I was going crazy. And so seeing a therapist was incredibly helpful because there was somebody finally who I could be really open and honest with. You know, because, you know, I was hiding all of this from all of my like friends and family, like what was really going on. But I could be really honest with them and they could tell me that I wasn't going crazy. And you know, and very kind of gently help me see that I was in an abusive marriage. And so, you know, it's no wonder that I felt like I was going crazy because I was kind of being made crazy. And so it's very quickly after starting therapy that I decided that I needed to leave.
Good for you. And how did you leave?
I made a plan. So that is the key thing, is not to jump straight away. I mean, as soon as I decided I wanted to leave, I wanted to leave yesterday. I could not stand to be there anymore. But I had to make a plan to make sure that, you know, that where I was going to was safe and secure. And so I found a place to rent. And I did all this, you know, quietly, because I felt that I couldn't talk to my husband about it. I felt that I would just have to leave. And so I found somewhere to rent. I did speak to my employer about my situation because everything was so overwhelming for me at that point. I couldn't cope with work. And they were very understanding and they gave me just several weeks of special leave just to be able to sort out, you know, this immediate situation. And so I waited until I knew that my husband would be out at work. Sometimes he worked from home, sometimes he worked out. And I took that as the opportunity to literally pack some bags, take my essentials and leave.
Wow. And did any of your family or friends know you were doing this?
I told my family, because I knew that he might contact them, you know, given that I just up and left. I did leave him a letter to explain that I was leaving. But I thought, you know, he may well try and call various members of my family. You know, who knows who he's going to call. So I did let them know. I also did inform the local police as well in case he rang them. So I let them know in advance, you know, I am leaving, just so you know that I'm like not a missing person.
Yeah, because I suppose he might find you if you were seen as a missing person.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
That's very wise.
Yeah. Yeah. So I researched, you know, what to do, like if you are leaving this kind of situation, just to make sure that, yeah, that they can't find you.
Did you research this at home? Did he have access to your computer? Was he kind of controlling in that way? Or did you research it at work?
I did research it at home. I did do it using a virtual private network?
Is it incognito?
Yeah, like incognito mode. So
yeah.
So it doesn't capture your browser history. I mean, he did have access to my computer, but I don't think he was monitoring it. I mean, I couldn't be sure of that, but I don't think he was.
Okay. Wasn't at that level maybe yet. Do you think that if you had said you were planning to leave, he may have got, well, obviously angry, but also do you think he would have got potentially more controlling to try to stop you leaving?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I'm not sure which way he'd have gone with it, whether he'd have got more angry or whether he'd have gone into the, you know, trying to lavish a lot of like love and attention on me, to make me kind of realize, you know, how good it can be. Or maybe he'd have tried both. I don't know. But probably he'd have got more angry. And one of the things that had been holding me back from leaving was I was not only scared for myself and like how I was going to cope. I could not imagine living on my own. But I was also scared for him. Yeah, I was genuinely, you know, worried, like, what is he going to do when I leave?
You know, how's he going to feed himself, right?
Well, that, but also, you know, I did kind of wonder, you know, is he going to do something stupid, like almost like as a reaction to me leaving, you know, something stupid to himself. But I had to say to myself, well, you know, I cannot give any more to this marriage. I cannot. So he's going to have to look after himself. I need to take care of myself.
Yeah. Absolutely. And we spoke about this once in the past, but you didn't have any children. Was this a choice? Did he want children? Did you try for children? You know, it's a very, very different situation when you have a controlling relationship with children involved, because they can use them to control you. And it can be very difficult to leave when you have children. Because they can see you as an unfit parent and strip the children away from you. So luckily in your situation, there weren't children. But what was your situation there?
When we first got married, neither of us were too sure whether we wanted to have children or not. And as the years went by, very, very gradually, I felt that I didn't want to have children, and my husband more and more felt that he did want to have children. So it was really interesting. He became the broody one. I know, you know, for a lot of women, they just have this like visceral desire to have children, just, you know, kind of an unexplainable desire. And I've never had that. And I kind of think, in some ways, you know, that was a blessing that I didn't have that. And I don't know, you know, if I had been in a healthier relationship, whether I would have felt differently.
That's,
I think,
really
there was
interesting.
I think there was maybe part of me that was protecting myself. And when I did kind of sit with myself and really, really think about it, you know, because my husband began to get broody and wanting to have children and showing me babies and aren't they wonderful? And I really, really thought about it. And I thought about how difficult our marriage was and how unhappy I really was. And I just thought, I cannot bring a child into this environment. I can't. He's not going to be a good parent, and I don't feel like I have a clue about parenting either, and it just would not be a healthy environment.
Well, more so that you don't really have anything else to give, right?
Yeah.
You're already doing everything. How can you care for and keep somebody else safe?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And so when you told him you didn't want children, Were you on something like the pill at the time?
Yeah, I was on the pill. Actually, it was really interesting because we had a big heart to heart about it, and and he talked about what he really wanted, and I explained, I don't think I can do this, can't have children, where does this kind of leave us? And at the end of that conversation, he said that, he really wanted to be with me, and he accepted that I didn't want to have children. And it was like a weight had lifted. And then it must have been about 3 weeks later, and he was beginning to talk about how he wanted children again. And he was like pointing to babies and how cute they were. And I just thought, did we not have this conversation about how I really do not want to have children? And it was, yeah, I think that was a little bit of a wake up call then. It was just like we hadn't had that conversation.
Like, almost like he was trying to work you, trying to manipulate you, trying to kind of say, oh, but I still really do want it.
Mm.
Did he ever suggest you come off the pill?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. And I did come off of the pill for a while, because he like temporarily convinced me that, that having children was the way to go. I quickly realized that it just wasn't, it was just that the prospect was kind of terrifying for me. So I went back on the pill.
Yeah. Wow. And you now have a new life, a different life, living on your own at the moment?
I'm living with a partner.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Exciting. A much nicer partner, hopefully.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
So this has been obviously a few years. Is it about four or so years?
5 years.
5 years. Yeah. You now have a new partner. You have started your own business?
Yes.
And what is it that you're now trying to do as part of that business? What is it that is your calling, as you might say?
My calling, yeah. Yeah, so I'm on a mission to help a million women like ditch people-pleasing and move into their confidence and their power by 2030. That's my aim. Wow. That is what I would love to do.
A million women in 10 years.
Yeah.
That's a good goal.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And what I've moved into doing is coaching women that have a really hard time saying no, which is really what I had trouble with, and helping them to build their confidence and to learn about boundaries, which is something that I never knew anything about and kind of realized that I didn't have any, and helping them learn about healthy relationships and healthy relationship skills, because again, it was something that I realized all the stuff that I thought I knew about how to do relationships, I had to unlearn a lot of it and just start again. And I just figure, we don't get taught this stuff in school, but we really need it. We really need to know like how to do relationships.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you come across women who are in controlling and or the same thing, potentially abusive relationships?
Sometimes. But people are in a lot of different situations. So I come across some women who they've maybe had a string of bad relationships, and they're fed up of, they keep attracting guys that keep dismissing their needs, and they can't figure out like why this keeps happening. For other women, it's actually about different kinds of relationships. Like it's their relationships with their parents, or it's their relationships with their friends, and they know that that they are people pleasing, you know, that they're always the one that arranges social gatherings, they're always the one that rings their friends, they're always the one that listens to everyone else's problems, and nobody ever kind of takes the time for them. And they're just at that point where they're realizing this and they're really fed up.
Yeah. Amazing. And so what sort of methods do you use? Are you coaching courses? Have you written books? What's your sort of current way of doing that?
I work one-to-one, using coaching and mindfulness and meditation. I also run a group program for women on basically how to stop people pleasing, and I incorporate a lot of different techniques and psychological methods to help break old patterns and to really to tune in to how we are feeling, because a common theme amongst people that find themselves stuck in people-pleasing patterns is that we've really learnt to ignore how we feel. We're really good at that. Like, we're really good at tuning into how everyone else is feeling, and we're often on high alert about how other people are feeling, but we've just forgotten to reference ourselves.
Absolutely. And what do you now do for yourself?
I make it a practice to meditate every day. And for me, that gives me space to really get in touch with what am I thinking, and, you know, where are those thoughts going, and to step back from them, and also to tune into how I'm really feeling. Because it's a practice. It's something that you have to practice. If you're so used to being other focused all the time, you have to make it a practice to learn to tune into yourself. It was possibly one of the most powerful things that I learned to do a couple of years ago, was learn how to meditate. Yeah.
Amazing. And if anybody wants to contact you, if they think that this is going to be helpful for them or somebody they know, how does somebody contact you?
Yeah, contact me via my website, which is just helensnape.com, or one word. And you'll also find on there like free resources for people pleasers and a blog for people pleasers as well. Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you. I have one interesting question as well. Your ex-husband, you said you lived briefly with his mother. Mm. I'm interested to know what that relationship was like and what you noticed, even maybe with hindsight, about his relationship with his own mother, being one a woman and another somebody who would have cared for him.
Mm. He acted towards his mother fairly similarly how he acted towards me. So he would fly into rages with her, and be very demanding. And then sometimes alternate that with being, you know, really like loving and caring. She did her best to manage it. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, how that can be for someone to have a child that kind of treats them in that way. Yeah, it was very difficult to witness.
And was she a single parent?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did he have any father in his life for any part of his childhood?
He did. His father was abusive, physically abusive as well, towards his mother, and I think towards some extent towards the children as well. So, you know, I know that that, you know, that he has his own issues to work through, you know, that he had an abusive childhood, which, you know, I've come to a place of acknowledging that that doesn't excuse his behavior towards me. It just, it can help just to kind of understand what somebody's background is and, you know, what kind of might be driving some of their behavior. But it's not an excuse for his poor behavior towards me.
Some of their conditioning, maybe.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Thank you for sharing that. I just think it was something that I've spoken to yourself and also somebody else with, a story which had many similar exact phrases, shall we say. Mm. And although they had a different situation, and I was just very interested to see what the dynamic was between him and his parents, especially mother, because I think that it is, can also be a potential clue.
Mm.
And whether somebody doesn't speak to their mother or has a bad relationship with their mother, or when you see them together, you can see how they treat them. I think, yeah, it can be an eye opener as to what they think is acceptable and normal.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really interesting you say that, because I remember reading somewhere about, you know, when you're, it was advice for daters, and it really got me thinking. It was to observe how your date treats the waiter or the waitress can be really, really telling. And when I heard that, I thought, gosh, well, how does my husband treat waiters and waitresses? And he was horrible to them. He was just really horrible to them. So it's, yeah, interesting. Just observing how they treat other people, as you say, like their family members, but also just like strangers as well.
Very interesting. And yet they could be highly charming and often,
oh,
are.
Gosh. Oh yeah. Yeah.
May I just ask, did you ever go to court? Did you ever press charges? Did you ever do anything like that? Or did you just literally leave and hope that he wouldn't find you?
About 3 weeks after I left, I filed for divorce. And left it at that. I mean, this was before, I think, new legislation about controlling behavior and how that's criminal. I left before that even came into law, but I was just happy to have got away from that situation, and to be able to start living my own life. I kind of think that's like the best, I wouldn't even call it revenge, but if you like, it's just for me to live my own life. And yeah,
absolutely. Can you tell me, I'm going to link in the show notes as well to this, but can you tell me a little bit about what the changes are in the law with regards to controlling relationships and the realization of the need for change on that legally?
So I don't know the detail of it, but my understanding is that, yeah, that controlling behavior is now, you know, a criminally actionable issue. But it's something that I haven't really looked into, because I knew it was sort of before my time. Yeah,
absolutely. I did hear from a friend as well that there's been a change in that the abuser, potentially, and especially in an abusive relationship, where they were allowed to effectively cross-examine the witness themselves. They were allowed to represent themselves.
Mm.
And that, bearing in mind these people are very controlling, often charismatic, often very good in powerful situations. Mm. They can, you know, get a judge and jury on side, you know, charm mm-hmm. them, etc. And yet they were the ones that were allowed to go and actually ask questions of the person who was effectively the victim in this situation. which seems just ludicrous when you hear about it, and yet this is what it was. And I have heard that that is also changed, and they're now not allowed to cross-examine their own partner, which just puts a little bit of a barrier between, because it could be very difficult to leave a situation like that in the first place, especially if you've got kids involved, and your confidence is incredibly low. It's hard enough to do that in the first place, let alone then be tackling that person directly in a court of law.
Yeah, I can't imagine that. You know, from when I first left my marriage, I mean, if my husband was cross with me, I couldn't think. Like, I literally couldn't think. You know, my brain would just kind of shut down. So I can't imagine, like, how you could even begin to respond to questions in court under that circumstance. Oh, God, no.
Yeah, mental, isn't it? So I think this is definitely something I intend to dip back onto again on another podcast with somebody with a slightly different but often very similar story. Sadly, it's almost like it could be the same man in a lot of these cases. And I'm sure it's not only men that do this either, but I think it's important to kind of voice it. So thank you so much for being brave enough and willing to put your story out there in this way. And I'm really pleased that the work you're doing is focusing on a wide range of women who they may not be in a relationship like this yet, or still, but they could easily get into one with that sort of mindset, conditioning, and lack of confidence potentially. So keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode. There's quite a lot of chat at the end there about legalities, and just bear in mind that when we had this conversation, I had not read any of it yet. So I have included in the show notes various articles and government website links to help you navigate this if you want to know more. So please don't take anything I said as absolute gospel, but I think I was on pretty much the right track. I'd like to say a huge thank you to Helen for sharing her story. I think that it's scary how the other stories that I've heard have sounded almost exactly the same in terms of the language that was used, in terms of the exact key phrases that are used describing their partner. And that was something that I wanted to share, because if anything in here resonates with you, the actual phrasing may be really bang on. If you'd like to get in touch with me following this episode or in general, you can contact me on Instagram at incrementaljane, via my website, canidoitmyself.com, or via Facebook or LinkedIn under Jane Tarrant. I'll see you again next time.